Okay, our TA Pablo is now in town, and I think he's starting his office hours today. There was quite a crowd yesterday in my office hours, but a lot of the questions were coming about problem set number two already. Most people are beyond problem number set one, which is due today at 5. Now, while we are waiting for this to happen, let's take a quick review of what we covered yesterday. We talked about divergence, we talked about curl. Okay, divergence, we derived it as a flux per unit area by taking the flux over a small rectangle and then shrinking it, and we saw that the del dot, the D formula, really corresponds to nothing other than the flux integral of D over a rectangular surface shrunk as it is normalized by the overall volume. So think of it that way. Divergence is flux normalized by volume, flux per unit volume of an increasing the shrinking volume. Okay? We didn't do the similar sort of a derivation for curl, but curl corresponds to closed loop integral of a vector quantity normalized by the area that is covered by the same closed loop as the loop is shrinking. And you can have this done for three different loops, therefore have three different scalars. They come together, become the three Cartesian components of the curl of an electric field or magnetic field, whatever you are applying to. Okay? And finally, I have not proven this, but I have said this. It is a Helmholtz theorem. If you know the divergence and the curl of a field in a given volume, also you know how you have some knowledge about the fields at the boundaries, you have all the information to reconstitute the field over the given region. All right, then curl. We define curl, but all of a sudden we started talking about curl-free fields. All of a sudden, instead of putting our attention with fields whose curl turn out to be non-zero, we started focusing on those fields whose curl are equal to zero. And why is that? Because that is what is relevant for electrostatics that we are focusing on, okay? So the relevant equations that we are working with is divergence of D is equal to rho and curl of E is equal to zero. Now, if you make up a vector field, E, arbitrarily, you take its curl, in general, it's going to be non-zero. It takes very special vector fields to have that property, but you have a recipe for that, okay? You can invent, out of the blue, a certain scalar field that we call V of X, Y, Z, all right? And that is the name that we refer to it within the context of electrostatics is potential function or the voltage function, and it relates to the voltage that we know from our circuit theory, okay? So if you have a V of X, Y, Z, and then you generate an electric field by taking its gradient, and by convention you stick a minus sign as well, then you generate an electric field whose curl is guaranteed to be zero, okay? And what's the big deal? Well, if a field has zero curl, then you can take its line integral from point A to point B, and you can go from point A to point B through any path, and you end up with the same line integral. This is not true for arbitrary vector fields. If the vector field is not curl-free, then it is going to have different values that you evaluate as you go from point A to B to different paths in the line integral. And we had an example, right? The example where we contrasted two vector fields. One of them was curl-free, the other was not, and we saw that we have either the same line integral result that happens over two different paths if the field is curl-free, and in the other case, that was not the case. Let's see. This is complaining for some reason. And hopefully it will come back to life. Now, the situation that we are examining here is very reminiscent of circuit theory, okay? In circuit example EC210, we have nodes, and at the nodes of the circuit, we associate with those nodes node voltages. We are in a position to select any one of those nodes and assign a zero node voltage. And then we talk about the remaining nodes having distinct node values. For instance, if they have a voltage divider circuit, we have a 6-ohm source, and we have 2 ohms, 2 ohms, we are going to have the freedom to select this as the ground and assign a node voltage of 0. We have here 6 volts, and we have another node voltage of 3 volts. And then we have a physical interpretation of these quantities, okay? If you take a charge and move from the reference to this particular node where the node voltage is 3 volts, is this happening? This is still not happening for some reason. I have some pictures that I want to show you because of that. I want this to work. Maybe I'll have to restart this. There we go. Okay, eventually I have some pictures to show. So here, the interpretation of this node voltage is the energy that I spend in taking a charge and taking it to this location, the work that I do normalized by the charge. And it has the same interpretation, the V function that we have, that gives us the electric field, has very much the same interpretation. And in fact, if we have a physical circuit with a physical battery, with a positive pole here, negative pole there, we are going to have positive charges here, we are going to have negative charges at the two poles of the battery, and actually the surrounding area around this circuit is going to be full of electric fields and the associated potential. We can look at it from that perspective, exactly. Any questions here? Okay, so then, the fact that there is a ground has a counterpart in this more general 3D problem, okay? I come up with some scalar function, V of x, y, z, and I take its gradient. The gradient gives me, with the minus sign, the electric field. If I add to my original function a constant value, that has no impact whatsoever on the electric field because the constant has no gradient to it, okay? So then you come up, there is not a unique one-to-one relationship between V and E, rather one that supports the possibility of adding a constant offset, okay? But whatever V of x, y, z you start to work with, at some location in space, it is going to evaluate down to zero, okay? You can think of that zero point as the ground point, the analog of this guy, okay? And then if you add something to it, to the whole field, the whole scalar field, what you end up is shifting the ground location to another location, just like you have the freedom to take the ground from here to this location in the circuit. That would be an awkward situation. This is the natural choice here, but you have that freedom. Okay, so the potential from which you get the electric field by just simply taking the minus the gradient has this one arbitrary constant addition to it. It is part of it. Okay, so later on, when we're talking about magnetic fields, we'll find that there is a potential that we can operate on, and it will turn out to be a different kind of operation. It's not going to be gradient, it's going to be a curl operation. Curl applied on a vector potential, A, that has three components, is going to correspond to the magnetic field. Electrostatic problems we can solve in terms of electrostatic potential, familiar to us and highly related to the concept of voltages that we have from circuit theory. In the less familiar world of magnetic fields, there is a vector potential and its curl ends up being the magnetic field. And there too, there is a corresponding freedom to adjust your A that may or may not work out the best in a given problem, okay? In a given problem, selecting the ground at the right place makes the problem easier. In a similar way, you can select an A whose curl gives you the B, but you have some freedom how to select that A. And the freedom there turns out to be you select whichever is the most convenient divergence of A that helps you, okay? Remember that if you have a vector field, you can fully specify it in terms of curl and divergence. You tie the curl of A to the magnetic field, and you select the divergence to be whatever gives you the easiest solution. Sometimes you say divergence of A is equal to 0, and that's what you want. Okay, for static fields then, the curl of E is equal to 0. And that then makes you only pay attention to the divergence of the electric field. That means once you know that you have curl equal to 0, all you have to pay attention is the divergence. And you know that that is enough to give you the electric field solution. Why? Because divergence is equal to, as we see there, rho. And rho gives you the electric field through Coulomb's law, if nothing else. Okay? So all static fields are summations of Coulomb fields. In that sense, divergence is good enough for static fields. And that is what exactly these equations are telling you. long as the curl of E is equal to 0, that is uninformative, but that has already dissed out a whole bunch of vector solutions. They are not going to be the solution of your electrostatic fields because it is violating the fact that it has to be curl-free. Then among all those curl-free equations or fields solution, you select the one that is consistent with this, and that comes from the Coulomb addition. Any questions? All right, so then I want to show you a few pictures here from... Here's a picture, here's a circuit, okay? Just, I want you to feel comfortable about this potential concept. We can call it potential, we can call it voltage. If you remember circuit theory, we usually talk about voltage differences. Voltage rises, voltage drops. It is never the voltage itself, but the differences do matter. And that's exactly the case here. Again, the differences matter, and you see graphically in this equation, isn't this a difference? Isn't the gradient a difference? Gradient is a difference normalized by state. People are sort of confused about what I say, but what is a gradient? It is a derivative, right? It is a ddx, ddy, ddz. What are each of those components? What is ddx of V? It is really taking V at two neighboring positions along x. That's the difference. Again, once you have potentials, what really matters, what gives you a physically measurable quantity, that is the electric field, is the difference. Difference normalized by the distance over which this difference occurs gives you the electric field. And it, in what sense, the electric field is the measurable quantity? Although V is not measurable quantity, but its difference is measurable. In what sense? If you have an electric field, you can do an experiment. And what is that experiment? Sort of like homework problem number 3 that you did, right? If a charge is put placed there, it's going to accelerate. So electric fields and magnetic fields are measurable quantities. Potentials are not, but potential differences are, because potential differences are effectively the electric fields and the magnetic fields. Any questions about this? Okay, so basically you have a battery here. Here's the positive pole, negative pole, but once you connect those poles with a conducting wire that has some resistivity through which some current is going to flow, charges are going to redistribute themselves over the surface of the wire, and then you can use Coulomb's law to sort of like figure out what is going to be the electric field distribution in the vicinity of this wire as well as the battery. There is going to be some distribution, and electric fields are going to point from pluses to minuses as you sort of like intuitively feel, and that direction is the direction of going from high potential to low potential, basically. Okay, and how high is that your high potential? It doesn't matter. You can always add a constant. Okay, so that's not relevant. You stick with some location to which you associate zero potential. Maybe in this problem, I would associate zero potential right there. That would be my ground, and of course, then the positive pole would have a lots of high potential. And the electric field is going to point from regions of high potential to low potential. Inside the wire, it is given by these arrows, and outside the wire, there's going to be some distribution. Now, if you wonder what that distribution looks like, actually, you can do some neat lab measurements or experiments that indicates that. So there is a very nice paper here that I want to show some pictures from. I'll put this paper, I'll link it to our calendar so that you can read it. Professor Jeffy Manco came up with some way of illustrating the fields that surround actual circuits. What he did is he came up with a conducting paint, but also transparent paint, and he painted certain conducting pads on a view graph, transparency, and then illuminated that transparency and took these photos while exciting these current pads with batteries. Okay, and the little darknesses that you see. He threw some chaff-like material, some seeds, I think some plant seeds, that have the tendency to orient themselves along the electric field lines. So you have seen iron filing types of pictures illustrating this sort of thing with respect to magnetic field lines a lot, maybe in high school or even primary school. This is sort of similar sort of thing, but illustrating the electric field distributions. Okay, so you have the positive and the negative battery poles, and then electric fields surrounding it, okay? So then if you go from this location to this location, you are going to experience a voltage change, okay, a voltage rise. And that is going to be the line integral from here to here, okay? Likewise, the line integral of E dot dl from here to here is going to give you the voltage drop. Okay, so it's exactly that's what we have been referring to in our circuit courses without showing perhaps the underlying field picture. Now you've seen it all. Any questions here? And this is all in the world of statics. In the statics, the currents that are flowing in these circuits are not changing as a function of time. Therefore, there are no weird inductive effects, which are important in AC circuits. In AC circuits, things become a little bit more complicated, but that we will learn in 2 weeks or so, in a week or so, when we say, hey, this equation is no longer valid. This is really the static case of a more general equation, Faraday's law. Del cross is actually minus dB dt, okay? And that then tells you how inductors work and how coupled coils work, how you can build transformers, exciting a primary coil, coupling to the secondary coil, and by changing the numbers ratio of the turns of those inductors, you can actually change the voltage levels that you put at the input versus what you pick up at the output. Anybody taking 330 in this course? This summer? No, there is no summer version, but some of you must have taken and you have studied in 330 the concept of transformers and so forth. Everybody should really take 330 at some point. Those materials, transformers and three-phase circuits, etc., those of you who have taken the course know, they used to be part of a required curriculum that we have. The compromise that I talked about at the beginning of the semester made us separate that into 330, which is a semi-required course, but every electrical engineer should take that course. Even if your main interest is not power, you're going to be a signal processing guy, still take 330. It is an important course. Okay, any questions about all this? So I will link this paper to the calendar, and let's go back to where we were in our lecture. I believe we went through this. Are there any questions about this example that I went through? It's sort of like a complicated example in that on one page I solved two different problems for two different fields. So I do it simultaneously. At the end, we have a lesson learned. For some field distributions, the line integral is path dependent. For others, they are not path dependent. And for statics, they are not path dependent. So we can uniquely talk about the voltage. Okay? Whether we move from this location to this location like this or like this, we have the same voltage. Okay? And likewise, when we look at a picture like this, then we have moved from an initial position to a final position, do a line integral. It doesn't matter through which path we do this integration, we acquire the same value. Therefore, to point P, we assign the same potential voltage. Any questions? And what is the interpretation of that potential? It is the energy per unit charge, okay? Because it is based on electric field, E dot dl, what is E? E is force per unit charge. Force times distance gives you work. It's an energy measure, okay? If you take an object and move it across certain distance by applying a force to overcome resistance, then you are doing work, okay? F dot dl, integration, corresponds to energy, something that you measure in joule, all right? But electric field is related to force. It is force per unit charge. Therefore, E dot dl is energy per unit charge. Okay, so E dot dl is your potential, V. Okay, when I go from here to here, I am actually doing an E dot dl. That gives me a number, and that is force expended. That is energy expended per unit charge. If I want to get the actual energy in joules, what do? I multiply that potential by the charge itself, and that gives me the actual energy gained or lost. Any questions here? Say that we have a potential of zero here, and say that we have a potential of 5 volts there. Okay? That is like having, or 6 volts. And that 6 volts is going to drive a current if the path is conducting. If the path is not conducting, that field is going to just sit there because it sees an open. If through an open, you cannot drive a current. Okay? So whether or not this potential here with respect to ground is going to drive any current depends on the material that's available there. Okay? And And if we have individual charges that are free to move under an attractive force, they will constitute external. Okay? But if we hold it there against a free motion, then it's going to be the potential energy that we are talking about. And then eventually when that potential energy is released by turning into an attractive motion that develops, what is that? That potential energy has become now a kinetic energy, okay? And that's what happens in free space as the charges accelerate and the potential energy is turning into kinetic energy. But if you are in a wire, you are not building up velocity because you are banging into other stuff that's in the wire, and that's what is then happening. As you bang and lose your energy, kinetic energy to the lattice, what happens? The lattice, say, heats up, right? That is why resistors absorb energy, okay? If you utilize a resistor to connect these two points, then you will turn the energy, instead of the kinetic energy, to the heat energy associated with resistors. And resistors always consume energy, I square R. Okay? Okay, so that's where we are. So please try to connect the stuff that are a little bit more esoteric that we are talking in this course to the circuit materials that you have learned and hopefully by this time quite internalized in your other courses. All right, so of course in the homework, you always have to do examples, and examples are not just talk, doing calculation. Here's a calculation. Let's look at this example for a moment. In this case, we decide to call the potential at the origin zero. We select this to be the ground. The electric field is given in this vicinity. We're just wondering what the general function of as x, y, and z, this potential function is, okay? I couldn't ask you what is the potential without telling you where the ground is, but I have told you where the ground is, therefore that issue is out of the way. Now it's just a matter of me doing an integral, a line integral, and I don't care which path I take because I've been told that this is an electrostatic field. But if you are doubting Thomas, how do you check whether the professor is right in claiming that this is an electrostatic field? What do? You take the curl, and it's identically zero. You say, I believe it. And then I'm going to be able to do what you asked me by finding the easiest path over which I can do this integral. Okay, and the easiest path is the one by dashed lines that I'm indicating there. Okay, because my electric field is a straightforward function given in Cartesian components. I want to go for the voltage drop from the point P to ground as the integral from P to the ground of E dot dl. Okay, what is E dot dl? Well, here I'm going to dot multiply this with dl, which is dx, dy, dz triplet, okay? And then, because it's going to be a little bit more convenient to move in this direction rather than the opposite direction, I swap around the integration point like this and put a minus sign there, okay? It's just going to be easier to go from ground, from the origin to the other point, at least for me, right? So that's why we did that. So we keep that minus sign, and here is our dot multiplication between this E function and the DL function, which is the triplet dx, dy, dz. Okay, so then now I have to implement this integration. This minus sign sits out there, okay, in each one of those, so I don't deal with that minus sign, but I wonder how I'm going to evaluate this integration. And I said this integration has a dx active part, dy active part, dz active part. Why don't I be smart and take my path is the one that is indicated by the dashed line. As I'm moving here in the first part, only dx is active, there is no dy, there is no dz, so I can forget about this portion and this portion. But also, as I'm moving here, my x is changing, but my y and z are not changing. What are they?
Zero.
They are zero. So I should take that integrand, and if there is any y and z there, I should evaluate them at zero. Of course, evaluating them at zero would zero it out, but in this case, I don't have y and z dependent, so it is immaterial. But still, for the completeness sake, I say my first part of integration is the integration from zero to capital X, that's little this little point here that I call, of 2x dx, evaluated at y and z is equal to zero. Evaluation at y and z equals zero in this particular case has no impact, but in some other situation, it will. Okay, so then I go across here. And now dy is active. So I pick up the dy active condition part of the equation. Like this. Then I have 3z dy, and I'm going to go in y from 0 to capital Y, because that's the length. But then I have to evaluate the integrand for fixed values of x and z. The fixed value of x is equal to capital X. The fixed value of z that I need to use is 0. But that function depends on 0, right? 3z. So this goes up. This becomes a 0 contribution. It doesn't contribute at all. That's why we have this guy here. And finally, we come to the last part, and that is the vertical rise. Okay, and that is coming from this quantity. And there we're going to climb from 0 to capital Z. And the function, the integrand, has to be evaluated at the fixed value of x and at the fixed value of y, because we have already gone there, right? That vertical line has the x and y coordinates corresponding to capital and cast and capital Y. Sorry. Yes, you have a question.
So when we're doing this and we don't have, like,
then you don't have what?
If we don't have, like, the graph there, we have to come with the graph showing us where
those. So that graph is Erhan's personal choice in answering this problem. Okay? Some other person would have said, hey, I'm going to do it in one way. Okay? I'm going to go across this slant line. But that person has to do a lot of work that Erhan doesn't want to do. Okay? Erhan wants to choose the easiest path that is consistent with his notion of what is easy and do it that way.
What I'm going to do is, like, do we just go with, if we're evaluating x, or dx, we always assume y and z to be equal to 0 at that point, and then when we evaluate I.
Only if you take that path. Only if you are taking this path in which y is not changing and z is not changing. That is the reason why you are taking dy and dz equal to 0. If you are not taking that path, suppose that you are starting with first with a slant sort of a path that first goes this way. This y is dz is equal to 0, but dx and dy are not 0. They are both non-zero. Okay? But depending at which angle you are going, there is a relationship between dx and dy. Okay, but now I'm talking 241 stuff. That's what math teachers teach, right? If you're going at the 45 degree, you can actually equate dy into dx. I think you've done this sort of calculation, correct? Has everybody done this? Yes. Okay. And now, you have done it 2 years ago, or maybe a year ago. And when did I do it? 30 years ago. So I avoid that like anything. Okay, I will do what's easiest for me. And when you grow old, you will do the same thing. Okay, you will find the easiest ways of doing things. That's how you train your brain. Okay, you burn stuff into it's just like FPGA or something like that. You program yourself in one way or another. Okay, but anyway, thanks for the question. I like people asking questions because when questions come, discussion happens, and I think other people benefit from that. Is that clear? Pick your own path. You have that freedom. Okay, utilize that freedom. You don't have that freedom if you are doing with an AC situation where the path dependent path integrals. Okay, this is why in an AC circuit, when you are making voltage measurements, sometimes the dial is going to do crazy things depending on where the leads are. Okay, with small lump circuits in the lab, that doesn't happen. But with large circuit, transmission line circuits, you try to measure voltages and you can't get anything right because it's sensitive on where that line integral is happening. Voltmeter always measures what is the line integral along the leads. Yes?
What about different mediums? Like,
so forget about medium for a moment. We are now in space. Okay? We will get into medium, and medium will have complications that will be producing, but we will get to it step by step. All right? So right now, this is a field in free space, and we are making voltage measurements. Now, medium is actually what's gonna happen is that medium is going to impact the field. Okay? A field due to certain charge distribution would change if you bring a nearby medium, okay? Or if you want to measure the same field as it is modified inside this medium, you have to deal with issues of polarization and so forth. The field inside will change. Okay. And but then with the change field, you will do a line integral. And that will give you perhaps a different voltage value. Okay. That is why the capacitance will depend of a capacitor, whether it is filled with air or a given dielectric, precisely for that matter. But let's postpone it for the moment. Right now we're doing a little bit of a math, and I think I'm done with my math, right? This last point is clear cut. This time we are evaluating at capital X and capital Y, and this gives us the result. Okay? So I went from the origin to a generic point whose coordinates are capital X, capital Y, capital Z. Okay, I had to use a different endpoints from the integrand so that I don't sort of like confuse the dummies with the final results. But now the dummies are done. I have done my integrations. Capital X, capital Y, capital Z can be turned back into small x, small y, small z. And there is my potential. So this potential is compatible with this electric field. Okay? If I add any constant to it, like 99, it's still going to be compatible. Whether I take the gradient of this or this plus 99, I will end up with the same electric field. Okay? Just for sanity's check, okay, you take the gradient, and that is shown that it works out to be the right thing. Okay? Oftentimes, the most common mistakes in these types of calculations are sign mistakes. Okay? And therefore, always check that, you know, you will catch your sign mistakes occasionally. And don't forget that electric field, the way we have defined it, always points from regions of high potential to low potential. Your sign mistakes will invalidate that. That's another quick check of seeing whether you've done it right or wrong. Questions? Okay, so that was one example. I have one more example. In this case, we have a proton sitting at the origin. And I am wondering what the potential is some distance away from this guy. Okay? My recipe to find the potential is to take the electric field and line integrate the electric field from the question of interest, where you want to get what the potential is, to what you consider to be the ground. Okay? And if I have a proton, its electric field is the Coulomb electric field that we know. Okay? And I know that if I have another charge infinitely far away, there is no field, because that field has petered out. But if I start from infinitely far away point and start pushing that second charge, the test charge, towards this charge, if they are of the same sign, I have to do some work. Okay, because this guy is trying to push that. Okay, I have to overcome that force and slowly move it. So there is some energy exchange that you have to consider. So the way we're going to do this is to get the potential at some point here. We're going to integrate from here to infinity. We will say that infinity has zero potential. We select our ground to be infinity. Okay, and that's the way this problem is done. So here we are. My potential is the electric field that is radially out. So my electric field is radially out in all directions. I'm going to start with a point on the z-axis that is going to be r away. I'm going to start at z equals r, and I'm going to stick with the z-axis and integrate all the way to infinity. Okay? If that is the case, my dls are all pointing in which unit vector direction? Say, you know it. I'm going to take the path along the z-axis. Therefore, if I break the z-axis into lots of dl components, my dls are all going to be pointing along. Right. My dls are going to be dz, z hat. Okay? Now, along that same z-axis, what is the field direction, unit vector direction? It is r hat, which happens to be also z hat. So when I do a dot product, z hat dots into z hat gives me 1. Okay, so therefore I'm really, what I'm showing here is e dot dl, and you see the dot product here. And when I evaluate that, z dot z goes away into unity, I have to do the integral from z equals r to infinity. And that's a pretty easy integration to do. Okay? And evaluations. I have to, when I evaluate z at infinity, that term gives me 0. You know, if I have fixed up in the denominator, that number is small. When I take it all the way to infinity, that is, there is no contribution. And then the second evaluations come at r, and that just gives me, and then I have to subtract. There is a minus sign here, and that's because of the integration. So my potential is E divided 4 pi epsilon naught r, okay? I guess this is something else that you should sort of like burn into your head. Coulomb electric field goes as 1 over r squared. Coulomb potential goes as 1 over r. They look sort of the same. And this Coulomb potential assumes ground to be at infinity, and ground at infinity is a natural choice here, because what we call ground, if you put r equal to infinity, this equation goes to 0. Infinitely far away from the proton, we have 0 potential. So this is another useful thing to sort of take into account. Now, this is potential. Potential is energy per unit, say, charge. So now if I say, what would be the potential energy of a proton that has been taken and placed at this location? Then I would take this quantity and multiply with the charge of a proton, which is E. Okay? What about for an electron? An electron has a charge of minus E, and I would multiply it with minus E. Okay? And that would be giving me in joules the potential energy associated. So the potential energy of a proton at this location, R away from the proton, evidently is a positive quantity. For the electron, it's a negative quantity. It's a positive quantity for the proton because those two protons which have been brought together, they don't want to stay together. They want to go away. Okay, so you have created this potential energy. If it releases, it is going to go and accelerate the proton away from the one at the origin, and it will get really fast. As you know, how did I do it? I spring-loaded it. By bringing the original proton all the way to this location close to the proton at the origin, I had to do some work. Now that work is going to be released and become the kinetic energy of this proton that's flying away. Now with electron, the potential energy is, say, positive or negative? Negative. Okay? And so, and then if it gets closer, it's going to get even larger negative. Okay? It's, in other words, the number is dropping. This is because there is attractive interaction between a proton at the origin and an electron nearby. That electron wants to go and join that guy all the way. But if it gets very close, an electron joining a proton becomes what? An electron joining a proton. What does it become? It has a name. We breathe it or we drink it.
Hydrogen.
It becomes a hydrogen, right? But it gets very close. Okay, some other new physics start coming into picture. And what's that physics? The quantum physics. There is then the uncertainty. There is a quantum forces that's due to uncertainty. Anyway, it just doesn't go and sit directly on top of that proton. It joins into it some sort of an orbit that you guys learn in chemistry and got all confused about. But nevertheless, that's what happens. Okay? All right. So a little bit of sort of discussion of that. Now, if you have a proton, there is a sort of an average distance the electron is orbiting around the proton, and that's called the Bohr radius. And Bohr radius has a value. Okay? It's sort of a complicated, it's based on fundamental constants of nature, including Planck's constant, but you evaluate it, you get 0.5 times 10 to the minus 10 meters. Okay? So that you can think of as the radius of a hydrogen. Okay? Now, diameter of hydrogen is twice that. So the hydrogen is how big then? 10 to the minus 10 meters. That's the size of a hydrogen. Okay? Well, all atoms, more or less, end up having this size. Okay? Now, you can build to a higher, sort of more massive atoms by adding more protons and more electrons. But then, the inside, sort of like, atom is a lot of emptiness, to tell the truth. Do you guys know the size of a proton? 10 to the minus 15 meters, okay? The size of an atom is 10 to the minus 10 meters. A proton is much tinier, 10 to the minus 15. An electron is sitting at a distance of about 10 to the minus 10. So atom is all emptiness. Who sort of figured this out? Do you guys remember from your physics courses? Rutherford. Rutherford did some experiments to figure out that most of an atom is just emptiness because he was doing these experiments, shooting small particles through a gold leaf, and it went through, but once in a while it came back. And once in a while what came back implied that there is a very dense core, okay? That core, if you just happen to hit that with your projectile, then you get reflection. So this is how Rutherford's model of the atom was obtained, and which is a very small core surrounded by some electron cloud. That electron is, don't even think of it as a point anymore. This is where quantum mechanics comes, and you have a probability distribution representing the electron there. That is what an atom is. Now the amazing thing is, if you build heavier atoms, and how do you build heavier atoms? Who builds heavier atoms? From light atoms. Who builds heavy atoms from light atoms? I haven't done it. The sun does it for us, and supernovas do it. Very, very energetic situations do it, right? So how does sun generate energy? it fuses four hydrogens into a helium, and then there is a mass difference, it turns out, E equals mc squared, right? That mass difference becomes what's hitting you and I when hydrogen is fusing into helium. And then these types of fusion reactions keep going, okay? Then helium can fuse into carbon, oxygen, lithium, etc. This is how heavy stuff is made. And then to make things even heavier, it takes even wilder, more explosive situations, these supernovas. But anyway, so as you are building this higher stuff, the size of the atom doesn't change because there is so much emptiness in an atom. Okay, now, so what? In a helium, you have two protons, two electrons. So two protons are each 10 to the minus 5. They get very close together. So the core is not much more extensive. The first electron gets drawn in because there is more attractive force because now the core has two pluses instead of one plus. Okay, and the second electron that you add is still hovering around at the Bohr radius. Okay, so 10 to the minus 10. And what is 10 to the minus 10 in terms of micro and nano stuff? Nano is 10 to the minus 9, so it's 0.1 nano. So when you are getting real close to, you know, building structures that are becoming atomic, this is where you are now moving from the world of microelectronics into nanoelectronics. In nanoelectronics, you're really starting to see individual atoms in your system, okay? And we used to have a building called Microelectronics Center some 5 or 6 years ago. Its name changed. It is now MNTL. N stands for nano. So as we are getting smarter, we can do these more adventurous, more benefitable new systems that used to be hard to handle in the past. Okay. So this last calculation is calculating the potential at the distance that corresponds to Bohr radius. In other words, at 0.5, 10 to the minus 10, I evaluate this, and I get 27.2 volts. That is the potential. Potential is measured in volts. Okay. This is actually potential difference with respect to all the way to infinity, where the ground is. Now, if I multiply this with the charge of a proton, which is 1.6 times 10 to the minus 19 coulombs, I will get the corresponding energy in joules. But people are lazy, okay? Instead of doing that, they say this in electron volts is the energy associated with the proton sitting at that distance, okay? You multiply by E, but you don't carry out the multiplication. You change your units effectively, okay? So 1.9 times 10 to the minus 1.6 times 10 to the minus 19 becomes the conversion factor between joules and electron volts. Likewise, you say, if I were to bring an electron there, I would have, for that electron, a potential energy of minus 27 electron volts. Anyway, that's how physicists do it, and also electrical engineers building these systems should know how to interpret this unit here. Any questions? Okay, so we are done with this lecture. That takes us to the next lecture. And I think that is Monday's lecture, isn't this? So do you guys want me to shut up or continue? How much time do we have?
5 minutes.
Any questions? Let's say any questions. Homework questions. What about that? Is the charge in that box increasing or decreasing? Has everyone figured it out? Problem six. Five? Six? Homework number one. Six. Is it increasing or decreasing? It's increasing. It is increasing. And therefore, the electric field flux is also increasing. So that was that. And I don't think there are any more mysteries in that homework set. I guess let's stop. We will continue with Monday's lecture starting on Monday. Don't just say what happens at t equals zero and say what happens immediately after, but don't worry after or beyond the immediately after.
There's only one more bus to be captured. Yeah.
Can you also start by defining the potential function as the gradient of the work function?
The work function?
Yeah. I mean,
so in physicists are very nonchalant about these things. Normalizations are divisions, and they don't care. Okay. In other words, is potential per unit charge, or just potential? In physics, it's unclear sometimes. Okay. And usually they set E is equal to 1, H is equal to 1, C is equal to 1. So given that, it doesn't matter. Okay. And whether it's work or work per unit charge depends whether you are working with force or force per unit charge, which is electric field. So I don't disagree with what you're saying, but I think as an electrical engineer, you have to be precise. Because physicists dream things and then pass it for implementation to electrical engineers, okay? Electrical engineers better do it right and not make it break, right? So this is why we are very careful. In our Laplace transforms, we stick with certain sign conventions and etc. You take an EC 210. The physicist doesn't even define a Laplace transform. He deals with Fourier transform, and once in a while, his omega becomes complex, and then so okay, I'll deal with a complex omega. It is a Laplace transform, but he doesn't care about it. Okay, so now you used to be a physicist. Now you're training to be an electrical engineer, right? So I think adopt both perspectives. Yes.
You know how many physicists have seen becoming electrical engineers?
But this guy is half my. I mean, he's not as young as you. Okay. He has taken a decision later on in life because he likes computers.
I have a 37-year-old physicist doctorate that I work with at Everett.
Yeah.
He's working there as a part-time job.
Sure. Yeah. Because look, what is electrical engineering? It's just applied physics, right? Now you want to be a computer engineer, right?
Or electrical engineer.
Which one are you in?
I haven't decided.
You haven't decided. Are you enjoying it?
Yes. Oh yeah.
Okay. I mean, you know, most of this stuff is just
at
review.
The moment, yes.
Yeah.
Transmission lines will be a bit there.
In this class. Beyond that, mm-hmm. What about 391s and all that? What's that?
This is just ENM.
This is ENM. So he's done it many years ago. He did a PhD on this. Yeah. Yeah. But I don't know what you did your PhD on. What was your
subatomic problem? Particles.
Okay. Subatomic. The stuff that I was sort of talking about today. Yeah. But you didn't apply that. You just went into the lab and did more programming, as I understand.
I was working at CERN. It was experimental.
CERN. You were experimenting.
Yes.
So you were building circuits then, basically. What does a CERN experiment?
Detectors. A larger level.
Okay. And some signal processing?
Not so much. No.
Not so much. But somebody else was doing that.
There were other people doing that. Yes. Okay. I thought it would be cool if I could do that too.
Did you choose to leave CERN?
Long story.
Yeah, very long story. How did you choose to leave CERN?
Yeah.
You said all circuits.
No, the guy I work with. The lump circuits that we are working with, they are associated with what we are talking about: static fields, quasi-static fields, curl-free. But the transmission lines that we will get into at the end of the semester are going to be dynamic, not curl-free. We're going to see both. Okay.
Transmission
line? Just wait. Or go into the calendar and look at lecture number, 30. 30 to 39 is all the world of transmission line. The transmission line, physically, is a coaxial cable, right? The coaxial cable that you have in the lab is a transmission line. If it is being used at a high enough frequency so that this much of a coax line is like a wavelength or even longer than a wavelength, then it's a transmission line. If the frequency is very low, that transmission line is not any different from two wires in this sense. Okay? All right.
I was just wondering, on this problem,
mm-hmm.
How do you know which sign to put?
Okay, so you have to sort of like look at that example in class notes.
Right.
But the other thing that you need to sort of take into account is follow. If you have a Q of 1 Coulomb, okay, uh-huh. And then if you have a circle here, the flux that it generates is plus 1, but that flux is defined outwards.
Right.
Okay, so then you can divide that by 1 into 2, and you can associate half of it upgoing, half of it is downgoing. Okay. And then it doesn't have to be a circle. You can distort this into a long rectangle and say, as the rectangle is becoming increasingly long in both directions, I'm going to associate half with this and half with this. Okay?
Okay.
So then, that is the flux. And that is the flux defined away from the charge. Now, in this problem,
I'm saying that we are interested in the flux calculated for a plane, just like in this plane or this plane, but we are defining that to be positive in the plus x direction, okay? So in the plus x direction, flux is defined to be positive. That means that that arrow direction is going to agree with the flux coming from this. So this is going to contribute with a plus sign. Q2 divided by 2 is going to... But the flux of this guy crossing the x equals 0 plane naturally would be in this direction. And that would be Q1 divided by 2. But the flux we want to refer to is coming in this direction. So you have to then negate the one that is coming from this one.
Okay, so like...
That's correct.
Okay. That's what I thought, but I was just making sure.
But now I told you the full story.
Okay. Thank you.
I was just listening.
Oh, can I ask you one more question?
Yeah.
It's about number 8 on that problem. I don't know where to start.
Okay. You have to take ddx, ddy, ddz of x over r, y over r, z over r. Okay? But that r contains x squared plus y squared plus z squared. So this
right.
is a calculus problem.
Right.
When you take the partial derivative, you have to do the derivative of a ratio. Okay?
Okay. So we don't need to deal with like the spherical unit vector at all?
Right. Because we are not defining. The advantage of defining and using it is that this calculation becomes easier. Okay?
Right.
Then it can be... But then you have to look up the equation and just use it once you have seen it. But we are not reviewing this.
Right.
I know that you have seen it once upon a time in this calculus course,
right.
but probably you don't remember it. Probably you need to look up. You can do this problem without remembering that formula
right.
in Cartesian coordinate system. And that's why we are asking you to do this in Cartesian coordinate system.
Okay.
Okay?
Thanks.
In other words, the del operator, which is in terms of dx, dy, dz in Cartesian coordinate system, is more complicated operator
right.
in spherical coordinate. In fact, it's not a single operator. You know, the formulas for taking the divergence and curl and gradient do not lend themselves into defining a single del that dot multiplies or scalar multiplies or cross multiplies. These are nasty equations to remember.
Yeah.
But if you do a lot of those calculations, better use those equations.
Yeah.
But if you're going to do it once, like here, do the del.
Okay.
That's
I saw the harder formulas in physics 225 when I
yeah.
took that, and
yeah.
they're not fun. So.
Yeah. So, but once in a while, if you're in a portion of study where you're doing this routinely, you're better off using those.
Yeah.
And this is what happens in 350 when you do antennas radiation, because antenna radiation is going in a spherical sort of a fashion, and it's better to use spherical coordinates, and that's what happens.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, Professor.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.